Hey, this is Captain Lee, and you're listening to the Andertons podcast. Hey, everybody, welcome back to Andertons TV. I've got an amazing, amazing guest today that we're going to shoot the breeze with for the next half an hour or 45 minutes or so. It's only Chris Shifty Shiflett. Many of you will know Chris, obviously, from Foo Fighters, but there's a ton more to him than just that, including, you know, some recent solo albums and tours and stuff, which we're going to get into. But Chris, welcome to Andertons. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, nice to meet you, too. I've watched your videos online. As a fellow member of the online guitar community, I am.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure
your videos, too.
We'll share war stories of what it's like. But look, tell me about, we're a similar age, so I'm kind of hoping that some of your earlier influences will remind me of things that I was listening to growing up playing the guitar. But, you know, so tell us about life growing up in California and some of your earlier recollections of what sort of began to shape your interest in the guitar and music.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I always give credit to my older brothers because they were really, guiding light musically on everything. And I was born in the early 70s, so you can kind of imagine what was going on in our house musically. It was just all the classic rock stuff of those years. Leading into, you know, as you get into like the late 70s, into the 80s, hard rock starts to turn into heavy metal. And then glam rock happens, and then punk rock happens. I mean, you know, punk rock happened way before I got into it, but like for me, it happened at a certain point. And on and on and on. And then moved to LA when I turned 18 and, you know, was like a young guy out there trying to play guitar and make it and do all that stuff. And that would have been like the 90s, and then music was changing, and, you know, it just keeps evolving.
Did you have a formal guitar education, or are you largely self-taught?
No, I did. Yeah. To a certain extent. I mean, I took a bunch of guitar lessons. I went through that period, like I took my first guitar teacher might have been the one that had the most impact on me because he made me learn Beatles songs and taught me a couple of scales and taught me all my cowboy chords. And none of that seemed particularly sexy or interesting at the time because I wanted to play guitar like Randy Rhoads, you know what I mean? But in the long run, that turned out to be some of the best stuff and the most important stuff. Because, you know, I always say you learn Beatles songs, like those Beatles for Beginners guitar books, and you're just sort of inadvertently learning music theory and you don't even realize it, you know, because it's all in there, you know, the way those chords kind of work together and key changes and all that kind of fancy stuff. I took guitar lessons from my first teacher for not that long. And then this would have been like early 80s. So everything you read about your favorite guitar players was that they studied classical music, right? You know, Yngwie and Randy and all these guys, and Ritchie Blackmore, whoever, you know, they're all like classically trained guitar players or whatever. So I took some classical guitar lessons and was terrible at it and couldn't read and would never really practice and was kind of unmotivated and really too young and just unable to like connect that to what I was listening to. Like I would take these classical guitar lessons, but I couldn't, that didn't relate to Blizzard of Oz or whatever, you know, like I couldn't put that all together. So I did that for a little while and then started playing music with my friends, as you do, and then took some guitar lessons from another teacher around Santa Barbara where I grew up, this guy, Steve Miles, that taught me, that really started like explain how to play guitar solos. And that coincided with high school and high school bands. And you know, from that point on, it was just kind of off to the races. But even still, like, I always dip in here and there. I always take a lesson here, take a lesson there. And I got a lot of holes in my theory knowledge, but it somehow it all, you know, it is, you just kind of learn by doing.
I'm most familiar, obviously, with your work in the Foo Fighters. I had a good listen to all your solo stuff over the last two or three days. And obviously it's, you know, it's quite, well, not quite different. It's very different, much more traditional kind of American country rock kind of stuff. In the Foos, I feel like the guitar parts are layered in a way that requires a good understanding of theory in a way that when it's your own stuff and it's probably just you playing guitar, you can kind of, you know, like you say, lots of cowboy chords, lots of perhaps more rock and roll traditional stuff. Whereas,
yeah.
So how do you, How do you cope with putting a Foo's song together where particularly maybe even live there's three guitar parts and you're going, so where am I, where do I sit in all this?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question because Dave, Dave's writing the songs in Foo's and I don't know how many guitar lessons, he kind of taught himself, I think. One of the great things, one of his strengths, I think, as a guitar player is that he comes up with all these kind of unorthodox chord shapes and open strings ringing out and things that he's just like figuring out by ear. And there's a lot of that in Foo Fighters. So a lot of it is really sort of breaking some of those like theory rules. So you have to let that shit go. I mean, it's like it helps to know some of that stuff, to know how to build something kind of around it, but you can't be hampered in by it either. Like, you can't go to the minor third there. That doesn't make any sense. You just have to let those things kind of go. It's been a huge education for me as a player through the last, whatever it's been, 20 plus years, trying to come up with parts in songs that sit nice with what he's doing, and with what Pat's doing. We're all sort of like trying to, it's like a puzzle, when we're making a record. Usually I'm not even thinking about the theory side of it. I'm almost more thinking about like tone and maybe where I am on the neck, and rhythmic stuff that's going to complement whatever the foundation of the song happens to be. But yeah, no, it has stretched me out many times, on that side of it for sure.
I think it's one of my favorite elements of listening to a Foo Fighters record are those two multiple guitar parts going together and how they've gone together in quite a signature sound for the Foo Fighters. But let's just dive back to this sense of your early sort of live touring days. Your early bands are described as punk bands, and I kind of, it's a big old genre of music that, but what were your influences there? And what was that? What drew you towards, playing that style?
I mean, my early bands were not punk rock bands. It wasn't even a band, just me and my friends making noise. All we knew how to play was like Last in Line or something by Dio. We just played that riff over and over again for like an hour and then went and watched videos or something, So, and then my early like high school bands and stuff were like rock and roll bands. When you're first starting out, you're just covering Kiss songs and stuff. So, but in high school, like where I grew up, the music that I was listening to was like, a lot of the stuff at that moment when I was really first started playing in bands, it was a lot of stuff that was happening in LA that was kind of like at the club level and hadn't really, become a well-known yet, like all that early glam rock and roll stuff. And then also bands like Hanoi Rocks that we had discovered sort of towards the end of them being a band. And that was what we were drawing from mostly, but I just kind of fell into playing in some punk rock bands here and there because that's what was around. If you went to a keg party where I grew up in, 9th or 10th grade, it was like if there was a band playing, they were either going to be a punk rock band, thrash metal band, or maybe a ska band.
Right.
But it was definitely not going to be a band that sounded like, Guns N' Roses or Aerosmith, or like there was just no real local scene for that. And I had this little group of friends and that's what we were kind of into and trying to do. But in high school, you wind up playing and always in like two or three bands at the same time. And so I wound up playing in like a band called Legion of Doom. I was in a band called Rat Pack and that stuff was more like punk rock stuff, which was, you just get turned on to it. It's just what's around. And 8th, 9th grade, I was kind of into skateboarding and that was sort of tied into so you just start getting exposed to it. And it's also just rock music, at the end of the day, it's not that much different,
So you must have had 10 years, I guess, of jumping from one band to the next or whatever before the audition for the Foo's came along. There's something on...
Oh.
Or is it more?
More than that.
More than 10?
Yeah, more than that. Yeah.
Okay, I was trying to think. I think I was probably 16 or 17 before I was in my first sort of proper band, and that would have put me right at the end of the 80s. But it's a similar timeline, right? Or were you gigging much younger?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I started playing in bands, like high school bands, like when I was about 14.
Right.
And then moved to LA when I was 18 and was playing around, and then moved to San Francisco when I was, I guess, about 23. I think 23, 24 was when I joined No Use, and then did that for 4 years or so, and then auditioned for Foo's when I was 28.
I hate to be that Wikipedia guy, but there's a line in there, something about a Guns N' Roses audition. Has somebody made that up, or is there any truth behind that?
It's not really true. It's sort of like you know, it doesn't matter that it's not true because it's stuck to me now. Right. And there's another one that I was going to be a pro footballer too, which also.
Oh yeah,
true. But those are my two big internet rumors. Yeah, neither one are true at all. No, I never auditioned for or played in Guns N' Roses, although I certainly would have given the opportunity.
Would that have been around the time Richard Fortus got the gig then? Is that that kind of...
Well, what it was my friend Bill called me and said, or I don't know if he called me, but we were on the phone talking about stuff. And he said, I heard Guns N' Roses are auditioning guitar players. I think I could get you an audition. And in that conversation, I said to him, I heard that Foo Fighters guitar player just left. Do you know, could you get me an audition there? He goes, oh, I think I might know somebody that works somewhere within that whole thing. So it was really my buddy Bill talked to a lawyer friend of his that was ultimately how I got an audition for Foo Fighters. So it was sort of like based in that conversation, but like nothing ever came of the Guns N' Roses audition. It just never happened. So I must have talked about that like 20 years ago in an interview, and somehow it just became
become a thing.
You know? Yeah.
So
no truth to it.
I am always, it's like it's a bit of a dream, isn't it, for any guitar player to feel like they could achieve being in being in a band the size of the Foo Fighters. You know, there's not many bands out there that truly do the stadium thing well, and obviously, you guys are one of them. So, what is going through the mind of a, you're not crazy young at the time, but still relatively young. And all of a sudden you're going from I assume, you're still living, relatively month to month on the kind of money that would have been in that sort of early band. And then somebody says, or there's this band where probably Dave's already a multi-millionaire off the back of it. And you're thinking to yourself, this is life changing.
It was life changing in a lot of ways. Foo Fighters were like my favorite band at that time. And when, like every time when I was in No Use for Name, when we would talk to our booking agent, we'd always be like, get us a Foo Fighter gig. Like, we want to tour with, we love the Foo Fighters. So that part of it was super exciting because I didn't know them personally before I started playing with them. So it was like, you're joining this band that you love and getting to know the people in it. And it couldn't have been a bigger dream come true. And then of course it was different in terms of like the size and scope. I mean, they were a band that I would see their videos on MTV, they do big tours and on the cover of magazines. Like that whole side of it that I'd never experienced was wild. Looking back, from this vantage, like even though I wasn't a kid, I was 28, I was already had toured a bunch and wasn't all that young. It seems like I was. It seems like we all were. I look back on that time and I see pictures and we look like we're all like 15 years old. It's funny. And it was an interesting time to join because I didn't really know that much about how the music business worked, beyond what I'd done, which was like in this little wing of it. So in my mind, if a band was on MTV, they probably all lived in mansions and drove Ferraris and I didn't know anything. Coming into it at that time, because that was right after they'd made the third record and were just about to start touring, it was just interesting to see the realities of all that, like, and to get to be there for the band building up this live fan base over the years. That was, people never believe me, but it was a lot smaller in that regard in those days. You know what I mean? It was like, I remember that first year of touring. I mean, we did a Chili Peppers tour. So that was like in arenas, but we were nowhere near like headlining arenas and stuff. Nowhere near it.
Wow.
We were playing like clubs and theaters and stuff, big clubs and theaters and that size venue. And it wasn't until we put out the next record, we got into like arena level touring. And that was, by the way, only in the UK.
That's interesting.
And nowhere else. You know what I mean? And so I got to be there for that. I missed out on those couple records and that period, which I wish I had been there for. But I did get to be there for a lot of the ride, and the ride was pretty great.
You've shattered my illusion now. So what you're basically saying is that, you know, if I manage to join some of the, you know, one of my sort of hero bands, I may not have the mansion and the Ferrari within the first 12 months of, damn it.
To be perfectly honest, I still don't have the mansion and the Ferrari. But I suppose, like, I could if I wanted.
But look, there must be a couple of, you know, almost bits of practical advice. If anybody watching this finds themselves in that scenario where they've gone from, you know, 8-10 years experience in a band that's maybe playing a 500 people or 1,000 people or whatever, perhaps you're almost always the support tour or whatever. What's a bit of practical advice for someone that's going to go, oh no, actually now there's 20,000 people in the audience. Presumably the whole stage craft changes because of the size.
I suppose, I don't know. I think about that sometimes. I think in a lot of ways it's harder playing smaller places because it's just the crowd's right there and they're kind of right in your face. But I suppose maybe it's harder to project in a bigger place. I don't know. It's a really good question. I don't know, because through those years, I feel like Dave really evolved a lot as a front man. You know, if you go and you watch footage of him when the band first started versus now, I think he's got more command of the stage or whatever now. And that's the most important part. He's the one that's out front leading the charge. So, yeah, that's a good question, man. I feel like, honestly, like it happened in this gradual evolution for me. So right. It was just, I never personally went from like playing to 200 people to playing to 100,000 in that way that might have been like, you know, might have thrown you a bit. It was like you just keep building and building. And so it felt natural and like comfortable. Although I will say, I remember on that first tour at the very end of it, we played Rock in Rio down in Brazil. And that was crazy. That was like a massive step up from anything I think, you know, certainly anything I'd ever done. It was like hundreds of thousands of people. And that definitely felt like a jet engine roaring in your face. And I think you're either, if you enjoy playing live and being out on stage with a loud rock and roll band, you're just going to take to it. You know, that's like what you've been dreaming of your whole life. So you just want more of it, I think.
were you watching old tapes of AC/DC and Queen and all in South America and just going like,
yes.
And is
absolutely.
Was it a bit like that? I mean, because they say that, like the land moves and everything. There's just so many people.
Yeah.
It's just.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. For sure.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, that still might be one of the biggest gigs we've ever played. And that was 24 years ago or whatever it was.
You know, when I knew we were going to meet up on this, I didn't really want to make this like a whole Foo Fighters piece, you know, even though, you know, you've been in that band for 25 odd years or something now. I think I was more intrigued to feel like once you've hit the sort of the highs of being in a band like the Foos with all the success that comes with it and the trappings that comes with it, what is it that still motivates you to feel like you want to go back to, you know, sort of the perhaps more rootsy stuff and your solo project stuff and almost, you know, and all the hassle of trying to get smaller tours off the road again and self-promote your records and all that. Because it presumably it was an entirely feasible option for you to just not do that. You know, you could have just carried on.
Sure. I never have a great, I get asked that all the time. And I never have a great explanation for it. I don't know, really. I'm just driven to write songs and want to go play them, and it's fun, and you get these little victories that feel bigger than they really are.
Right.
You know, when you sell out a 200 cap room, you're like, yeah, we freaking did it, yeah. Which I think on that side of things, having kind of played everything, every kind of gig you could ever play, like, it's not lost on me how hard it is to sell even one ticket, much less to sell out any size venue, whether it's 200 cap room, an 800 cap room, an arena, whatever it is, wherever you put yourself, it's just not easy. Part of the motivation is I love being on stage. I love playing. I love playing different kinds of music, you know, especially the older I get. I love how different tonally my solo music is from what we do in Foo Fighters. I just get to explore a whole different, like different guitars, different amps. I mean, I'm actually not even playing an amp in my solo thing anymore at this right. at this stage. I've been working in a quad cortex, which has been really fun and interesting. And they just kind of reflect on each other. The stuff I do at the macro level obviously has a huge impact on what I do at the micro level, but it also works the other way around, especially with like singing and stuff, just being able to go sing a lot. You realize real quick, being the singer in the band, you're on a whole different tour than the rest of your bandmates. You have to like think about your voice all the time. Don't talk too loud. Don't stay out late. Don't, you know, get sleep, drink water. All that stuff. It's just it's a different thing, but I love it. And I think really the biggest motivator is I'm still obsessed with guitar playing and I just love writing songs.
I really enjoyed it. I was listening to three of your solo albums over the last couple of days. The latest album feels a slightly more eclectic mix of music, of styles of music, whereas the earlier solo albums feel like you're staying in a more that sort of, you know, country rock lane a little bit more. So is that yeah. just as you become more confident as a solo artist to feel like, you know, your songwriting can go in different directions? And
yeah, I mean, I think songwriting wise, I think you could probably take songs from any of the records and mix them up and it fit. It's just the production style. I feel like I've gotten more comfortable. Like when I made West Coast Town, it's the first time I made a record out in Nashville. I was working with Dave Cobb. I really wanted the production to sound like those records that I've been listening to, because it's just something that I hadn't gotten to do. So I think that was more important to me at that point. Whereas the latest record, you know, you got big crunchy guitars, you got twangy guitars, you got kind of everything in between. It's I think more and more of these records just become mix of all the different things. Cause I listen to all kinds of different music. My solo stuff kind of gets gets called country rock and it basically is, but I don't ever want to feel like I have to do this or I can't do that. I make those records to just not have any sort of boundaries with anything and just let the chips fall where they may.
You know, if anybody's watching this and haven't gone out and listened to the records, I really enjoyed the just, you know, letting the track. I put basically the three albums on like shuffle. So I was kind of hearing slightly older stuff and then slightly more recent stuff. I really, really enjoyed it. And again, I suppose you can't help start listening to it without somewhere in your mind going, you know, I know this guy's in the Foo Fighters. So is it? And it's quite fun to sort of just go, it's such a different release for you. I guess everyone in the UK and Ireland is going to get a chance to see this show as well over the next couple of months as well. So have you toured solo over here before?
I have. Yeah, I've done a couple tours over there. I did one back in 2019 and then we did one just about a year ago. And they're always great. You know, the UK and Irish audiences are fantastic. So we had a really, really good time last year and looking forward to doing it again.
That's great. And you bringing your own band
and
over?
And you know, when
working with guys over here?
I'm going to have my band with me. And when we toured there last year, my album wasn't out yet. So we had, I think, one song out and maybe the second song came out right after the tour. And we were playing some of the stuff from the new record. So that's always an interesting thing to play music that's not released yet to a live audience. So now the record's out. And we've learned like a lot more of the songs. We have most of the songs from the record in our live set. So I'm looking forward to that, you know.
Oh, well, we'll put some links below where people can go and find out about where they can buy tickets for that. If there's one near us, I'd love to come. It'd be fun to see it.
Where are you based?
So we're about 30 miles south of London. So if you're doing anything in Portsmouth or Southampton or London itself.
We're playing London at the, what's it called, Electric Ballroom? I keep wanting to call it the Electric Circus, but I know that's a Rolling Stones movie.
I will look that up and that'd be fun. But let's talk gear, because that's predominantly what we do. And I would I know you're a big Telecaster fan, or at least Telecasters with humbuckers on it sort of fan. What's the journey? You know, have there been periods of your life where your gear has changed radically, or have you tried to sort of stay? Go on then, take us through the journey.
Especially in the last couple of years, I feel like things have really changed quite a bit. It all started many moons ago. My first good guitar guitar that I got when I was a kid was is a Les Paul. So, and that's all I had for years. So I was very much a Les Paul centric humbucker kind of player, and I played, you know, rock music for most of my life, so that applied. And then as I got more into country, I bought a Telecaster. I didn't ever really use it much. It was sort of hard to wrap my head around. And then just over the years, I just sort of started leaning more and more that way, and then built some Telecasters with humbuckers for like Foo Fighter stuff. But for my country leaning stuff, I started playing my Telecasters a lot more. And there's I have a bunch of Telecasters, but there's a couple that lean to more than the others. Interesting to talk about, because even just this week, I was like watching videos of Tom Bukovac talk about EQs and stuff online, and then texting him and going, hey, how do I get the harshness out of my telly? You know, because for my stuff, you know, some of it's gritty and some of it's not. But even the stuff that's not, it's grittier than not gritty. You know what I mean? It's like that, I don't know where you quite put it. It's like that, you know, and you're always kind of battling that with a telly. And now I'm playing with my solo thing through this quad cortex. So it's all sort of finding that balance between what's actually coming out of the speakers and what you're getting in your in-ears. And it's just a lot of exploration and a lot of tweaking. I feel like I've been on this nonstop tone exploration in the last year. And with my Foo Fighter stuff, that's all kind of changed a lot too, because I had Dave Freeman build me this bitchin' new pedal board that's one of those RJM switchers that I love. It's amazing. And that just changed everything for the big shows. That's a huge difference. And now we've been on the road for most of the last year, and we finally had this little break, and our gear's like coming back home. And I haven't had a time to kind of assess pedals and make adjustments and stuff. So that's kind of where I'm at right now, tone-wise, with my live Foo Fighter rig. I'm going to be tweaking some stuff in this break, swapping out some pedals, trying some different things, because now I've lived with that setup for a while and gotten to know how to use it. So I have some ideas there. But yeah, so I always think of it like Foo Fighter land is way more humbucker and P90, and my solo stuff is way more single coil, you know, small combo amps, Princeton's, deluxe reverbs, things like that, AC-15s. I tend to kind of lean that way with stuff. And the occasional Marshall.
I'm very jealous. Everybody wants Tom Bukovac as their tonal spirit guide. So if you have his phone number, we're super jealous over here. Yeah.
I do. And I'm trying not to abuse it, but part of me just wants to FaceTime him every day. And
every
like,
day.
Wait, can you explain that thing?
No, I've never met him, but I'm a big fan of what
he's
puts out.
He's a very nice guy. Very nice guy. Very helpful.
Okay, again, I've not done the types of gigs that you do. I guess not many of us have. But I always felt like if I was, I would want to hear the amp behind me. And I know many guitar players now, either through choice or because, you know, no other option, are going in ear where they have no amps on stage, they can't hear it at all. As a guitar player who's obviously done both, what's the pros and cons, or what do you miss about one or like about the other?
There's nothing better to me than no earplugs, amp, guitar, boom. That's to me is the absolute best. However, I started wearing earplugs a long time ago because I wanted to preserve my hearing and all the damage that I've done to it over the years. And that is the worst thing to do for tone. Even with the fancy molded earplugs, it's just like as a guitar player, you're killing all the high end. It just sucks, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think I overcompensated for that for a long time by having too much high end on my tone, because I wanted to make it hear good, like sound good with my earplugs in. So I'm just, you know, it was probably too trebly and too gained up. Switching over to in-ears is challenging. You know, we're like for Foos, we're loud. You know, we've got loud, my amps are loud, everybody's amps are loud, the drums are loud, everything's loud. So there's a lot of noise on stage. And nowadays I'm singing more on backup vocal stuff. So I have my vocal mic on, and you realize that you're just pulling most of what you're hearing from your vocal mic, which is also terrible because it's 20 feet away from my amp. You know, it's like this washy room sound. So if it was just up to me, I would say, let's all turn our amps down and make things quieter. And maybe I wouldn't even have to wear earplugs at all. But like, that's not going to happen. We're a big, loud rock and roll band, and it just doesn't work that way. And, you know, we're playing gained up amps, and they have to be at a certain volume to make them sound the way you want to sound. So it's just not, that's just not an option. So you have to figure out something else. So I don't know what that solution is exactly. I know that other people take their amps, you know, they have their cabinets off stage. I don't know if we'll ever go that far. I'm going to try some different things. I had Dave Freeman build me these 4 single speaker cabinets, because sometimes we'll go and we'll do TV or we'll do a club show or something. And my rig in Foo Fighters is 4 412s. And I'm running everything in, you know, I'm A-B-ing between a Vox and a Friedman. And then both of those are stereo. So I've got 4 412s. It's not small. It's not easy. And you can't fit it into a little room. So I had him build me these 4 individual speaker cabs. And it's really cool. Like we played on Saturday Night Live last fall. And that was the first time I used that. And in my in-ears, it sounded exactly the same. It almost sounded better. But that's, you know, that's not a live show. So I don't know if that would work for live, but I'm going to try that at our next rehearsals, because I think that might be a nice compromise. It would certainly bring my stage volume way down. And it's just the size of a 412 when you stack it all together. Maybe I'll do that and put it kind of off to the side so it's not getting in my vocal mic as much.
No, it's a relief to hear that the Foo Fighters backline is actually genuinely backline and not just for show like many bands nowadays.
Oh, yeah. No, it's real.
It's real. I'm surprised then, how much have you experimented with just using sort of load boxes and stuff so that you can get an in-ear sound, but it is your amps and there's still some noise on stage, or you just decided to make the full leap to Quad Cortex?
Well, the Quad Cortex is for my solo stuff. And the reason that I did that wasn't really to do with the same, it's not for the same issue that mm-hmm. I have with stage volume in Foos. It's more for, I started that with, I actually got a Strymon Iridium, mm-hmm. that pedal first, and just stuck it on my board and then got rid of my amp. Because the hardest part on my little van tours is consistency. I'm go out with just a small crew. Oftentimes I don't have my own sound person. Mixing stage sound and mixing front of house are kind of two distinct skills, really. Not to besmirch any of the front of house people out there, but you know, I'm spoiled in Foos because we have our gear goes everywhere and our crew goes everywhere and they're great. And so it always sounds consistent and sounds great. On my own tours, it's a different setup every night. And you're playing like a little Princeton reverb. It's going to sound different with the power. Or it's going to sound different based on, you know, what the person sending it back into your in-ears is doing. And it would just drive me crazy because more often than not, it just wouldn't sound good. I don't know if I'll always do this, but I'm kind of at the point now where just to get that consistency, the digital stuff, because you just plug it in and it's the same thing every night. And I've even taken that to the next level where I have a Behringer rig up there with us, so we control our own in-ear mixes. Right. I just like it being the same every night. If not this exactly the same, I mean, you always have to make some little adjustments, but I like the consistency of it and just knowing that my Quad Cortex is going to sound the same tonight and tomorrow night. It's going to sound the same in San Jose as it sounds in Brighton. It just doesn't matter. It's just going to sound the same.
Does your
I like that.
How does your tonal spirit guide feel about this?
It probably looks down at me over it. I mean, listen, I will be the first to admit that I always, you know, when I would see bands that didn't have amps on stage, I'd go, ah, it's so lame. And when I would see bands that were using amp simulator, I just always poo-pooed it until I got one. And then I was like, this is the greatest thing ever. And now I have, you know, I have a few of them. I have that Tonemaster Pro, I have a Helix, yeah. I have the Quad Cortex, I have the Iridium. And they're all great and they're all different and they all kind of have their own characteristics. And like I said, you know, hey, with my solo stuff, if I had a big, huge crew and an endless budget, my stage rig would look like Black Market Music clearance. You know what I mean? And for sure. But I just don't have that luxury. So I'm opting for consistency and something that sounds really good.
Yeah. Oh, look,
But isn't quite as collectible.
No. And honestly, I think that's the one thing. I'm 99.9% sure if I was touring and I was either carrying my own gear or setting it up or doing my own, I totally see the attraction of going down the quad cortex route, you know, and like you say, are you profiling your own amps and stuff just to get a sound, or are you just downloading stuff you like?
I haven't. Yeah, I haven't.
Just downloading your own, yeah.
But maybe will at some point.
And are you using it with a sort of more conventional pedal board, or is it just everything is in that quad cortex?
I've got everything in there. And there are some gaps, you know, there's some things that it doesn't have that I might throw on my pedal board. But right now I've just got a tuner, which I don't need because it has a tuner, but I like my Boss pedal tuner. And I've got an expression pedal and I've got the quad cortex and that's it.
No, there's a sort of air of inevitability, isn't there? You know, digital is only going to get better as time goes forward.
Yep.
So, and it's undoubtedly crazy convenient and practical. What are you taking out guitar wise when you're doing your own stuff?
Well, I mix it up sometimes, but probably for the UK Irish stuff, it'll probably be my a couple of Tellys. Mm. I have one that's like a Fender Custom Shop. It's like a Blackguard. That's great. That's been kind of my main one for a while. But then I have this other one that's a Paisley Tele. That's actually a parts guitar, but it sounds great. I'll probably bring those. I might throw my Les Paul. I might bring a Les Paul too, because I brought a Les Paul with me to the last bunch of shows we did, and I liked having that as an option. You can never go wrong throwing a Les Paul. Country music on a Les Paul is fantastic.
Describe to me the difference. So when you're in the Foos and you've got 20 guitars off to the side of the stage and the tech can give you a new guitar for every song if you want to, versus your own tour where you're going to do the whole set with two guitars or something like that. Again, is there a sense that one feels better than the other, or is it just fun to be able to do both?
I would bring more guitars if I didn't have to check them on the plane, you know, to get over there. I would definitely bring more guitars if there was more room in the van. Yeah. I would like to have, there's a bunch of stuff I would like to have out on my solo stuff. I'd love to bring a Strat. I'd love to bring a Les Paul. I'd love to bring like my Flying V or an Explorer, you know, all that stuff. I do like having a bunch of different options. It's fun. Oh, I would bring my Cleaver that has the P90s. You know, I'd probably bring my non-reverse Firebird that has the P90. There's a bunch of stuff I'd love to bring. But I also like the simplicity of just having a couple of workhorse guitars that are pretty similar, and it doesn't matter if one breaks, you could get through the show. I'll tell you what, at Foo Fighters HQ, we have a rehearsal room. The only thing I have in our rehearsal room is an AC30 and an old pedal board that really only has a couple of things. It's not like my fancy scene switching thing. And a Les Paul sitting there usually. And when we rehearse, I like I like that challenge of, it's great to have all the bells and whistles and do all the different tone stuff and hard scene changes and all this. I love that. But I also love that if you took it all away, it's fine.
Yeah.
Just get through it. You don't need it. It's nice to have it, but you don't need it.
I think I find even in here, sometimes it's too easy to just have 10 pedals or a guitar with a Floyd Rose on it or an amp with many channels. Sometimes really what brings the best out of me is to just have the Telecaster and one sound. And then it's, you know, everything that you've got to try and get has got to come out of these. There's no, I would have thought that your solo stuff probably lends itself again to you going, do you know what? I'm just going to get it out of these tonight. You know, I wonder.
Well, I'll tell you something funny. So I have a bad tendency to go too wet with effects.
Yeah.
And you can really screw that up with an amp simulator, especially when you're on in-ears. And I didn't realize that at first. And then my guitar tech goes, oh, dude, you gotta set those tones on a powered speaker. You can't do it on headphones. It's gonna be way too wet. Yeah. And that was totally correct. And I think I have a bad tendency to make everything a little too wet anyway. When I got it, I went in and programmed a preset for every song in our set. I can have a different amp and change the settings for literally every song. So I did. And then that becomes, it's like too much.
Yeah.
It's way too much. You know what I mean? I sort of figured that out after doing a couple of shows. Like, your levels are all kind of doing this the whole time. And so there's that thing of getting everything to where it's about the same, kind of fighting the temptation to just put too much goop on everything. Like, here comes the bridge. It's going to go waka, 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 you know, and the tremolo is going to kick on. It's going to be in perfectly sync to the track and all, which is, there's something to that in, but you have to like, you have to be a little more disciplined about it, I think. So that's what I've been kind of doing this week, is dialing stuff back. Like, maybe it doesn't need quite so much decay on that reverb, you know, like maybe it doesn't need quite so much feedback on that delay, you know.
I think you're so, and I think every guitar player will do this circular journey. Because I think at the moment, if I had a quad cortex, and I've used lots of digital stuff just messing around with, I think I'd end up with a decent Fender Princeton sound and a Tube Screamer and a delay pedal, and I would do everything on that, which then begs the question, well, why not just have a Fender Princeton and a Tube Screamer and a delay pedal? Because I see a lot of guitar players who have literally, just because they can rather than they need to, got 30 patches for a gig. And you're just like, really?
Yeah.
It's interesting that you...
I know for me, it's nice because if I look at my records, I try to sort of do something similar. And I know for me that like my West Coast Town record, I was playing most of that record on like a Vibralux and a deluxe reverb and some stuff like that. And then for Hard Lessons, most of that, the guitar on that is through a JCM 800.
Wow.
Right. And then for my last record, I don't even know what I played on it because Jaron just brought weird little... combo amps and stuff that he had. So trying to sort of imitate all of those different sounds. It's great to, that is the beauty of it, is to have the ability to like, okay, when I play Liar's Word, it's going to be a big crunchy 50 watt Marshall. But when I play West Coast Town, it's going to be a Princeton or whatever. I love that, you know, but it is funny. Like you're saying, I've been kind of dialing it back now to like, I'm probably mostly using 2 amps in it.
Yeah.
And then it's just settings, and which is great. I think the main thing with guitar playing and with guitar tone and with gear is that it never ends. And like you could interview me 6 months from now and I might be like, dude, I'm only playing like, you know, I got my vintage Princeton reverb and I've got a Tube Screamer, that's it.
Yeah.
And then 6 months later it could be some other thing, and then technology is going to change and we're all going to go gaga over some other thing that we don't even know about yet. And it just goes on and on and on.
Artificial intelligence.
The only thing that stays consistent in that is that they just keep ruining guitars. So we just keep playing the old ones.
I love, you're not wrong, are you? I mean, it never ceases to amaze me in the guitar world how right all the brands got it in the first 15 years or so of the electric guitar being a thing. The amps are great from that era. The guitars are great. And as you say, what have we done over the last 50 years other than make it worse? I'm not sure.
the greatest modern invention in guitar technology is the clip-on tuner, for my money. that's the best.
Oh, man.
Everything else you could do without.
So look, if we've got 5 more minutes or something like that, let's talk about podcasts. Because, you know, again, like, why? What draws you? In fairness, I don't remember... tuning into the Walk the Floor stuff, so I apologies. I don't really know how that was different, but the Shred with Shifty is it. I love the concept. So I think it's quite hard with, you know, YouTube and podcasts nowadays to sort of go what's a new angle. But I really enjoy that sort of breaking down of a solo that an artist has done, and then, you know, having a wider conversation. But why?
Oh, yeah.
Again, what draws you to want to put yourself through the living hell of trying to produce YouTube videos?
I'm glad. It's nice to speak to, you know, a peer that understands the living hell that putting these things together can be.
I have to say, because they're in the room here, by the way, Taylor and Pete do the bulk of the living hell bit. I just do do the face bit. So... all the editing and stuff I don't know about.
Me too. I make notes and yell at people. That's my role. with this new show, like, it really is, every episode is a guitar lesson for me. And that was the driving sort of concept for it. And I'm happy to say that has really paid off. We're about to post my interview with Brent Mason in a couple of days. And I've every time, you know, when I'm actually doing the interview, I'm sort of like, I've sort of half learned it for the, just to sort of wrap my head around it. And then like, I'm kind of in the interview mode. So I'm not really picking up some of the nuances, but it's in going back and editing it where I'll watch this stuff over and over and slow it down and really try to like zone in on what they're saying and pick up some of the ideas. And it's great. It really like, what could be better than going and talking to all these incredible players and having them detail how they do what they do? It's the best.
I must be a bit.
Honestly, like I texted my producer the other day and I was like, we got to make like a guitar shred record. Get all these folks and get them together and just have an instrumental record that's just a bunch of guitar solos. That's put me in that mood.
I've just ordered the, and I can't even remember the song that he's done, but Mark Knopfler has just done that for a cancer charity in the UK where it's everybody who's anybody, you know, from the British guitar scene. Local Heroes is the song that he wrote, which was a theme tune for something or other. But anyway, so yeah, you can go and... It's a charity record, but so yeah, I sometimes think that those, you know, you get 20 or 30... egomaniac guitar players all in a studio and ask them all to contribute and the thing just ends up being a car crash, doesn't it? But
well, all you have to do if you want to see a great example of that, just go watch that Hearing Aid. Do you remember that Hearing Aid? It was the heavy metal version of Live Aid,
right?
And it's basically a Dio song and then there's like a 15 minute section of guitar solos in the middle of it. It's amazing.
I must admit, I think as a guitar player, I struggle. I get embarrassed almost for this because you can see all of the sort of the guys in the audience that maybe don't play or they, you know, and this 20 minute self-indulgent cacophony of off, you know, and you just go, why are they doing this? But hey,
my point of view on that has changed so much over the years where I always kind of lean to like 3 minute concise pop song, rock and roll song types things. Yeah. But I've gotten far more open to jam bandy, long drawn out noodly bits in songs than I ever was when I was younger. And I don't know if you're going to see much of that in what I do. But there's a couple of songs we might stretch out for this UK run of shows. We'll see.
I don't mind. You can go to 45 seconds, maybe 60 seconds for a guitar solo. But if it goes on for 15 minutes, I'll be at the bar. But
it's going to run until I'm out of hot licks.
Is what it is. Now, they say never meet your heroes. And I've got to ask you about the Ace Frehley podcast because you deserve whatever the Oscars of podcast presenting are. You deserve one for keeping that one on track. But I don't want to say anything. You know, Ace is obviously a hero of yours. So tell us what was that podcast like?
Oh, it was great. It was actually the second time I've interviewed him, and I really enjoyed it. It was nice to get to just hang and talk to him. He's so funny. Not afraid to talk shit, not afraid to be kind of self-effacing, not afraid to lay out who his influences were. And he'll just openly say it like, hey, man, I was just ripping off Jimmy Page and Jeff Beck, and I don't know. I like him. It makes me giggle to see how people react to him. I think he is interestingly very polarizing in the online guitar community. People seem to love him or really strongly not love him, and leave lots of mean comments on my YouTube post on it. But yeah, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot. Dream come true in a lot of ways.
It was a great, I felt he sort of goes through sections of being really lucid about what happened in the past. And that, you know, you'd get like 5 minutes of really interesting conversation. And then there'd be this almost surreal zero recollection of, I don't know, just like this. And I suppose you just end up going like, you can't live the life that guy has lived and end up being able to just recollect everything accurately.
Well, it's funny. You always have to bear in mind, as you know, I mean, the version that we put out is an edited version.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the tightened up version. So think about that. And and it's also like, you know, I do these interviews remotely And it always, it's interesting when I watch them back, because I'll do the interview and then I'll watch it and I'll make some notes for my editors and stuff. And in real time when I'm doing it, you know, I'm a little bit away from my computer screen and the person that I'm interviewing, depending on how good their Wi-Fi is. And this is, I mean, this applies to all of them, not just the Ace one. You know, they're small on my computer, so they're showing me stuff and you sort of, you lose ability to understand like where their hands are on the neck. So I'll see myself in the interview not understanding what the person is saying and playing it totally wrong, but I can tell by looking at myself that I think I'm doing it right. I see that kind of stuff all the time in the editing process, and it just makes me giggle. It would maybe hopefully one of these days we'll be able to do some of these in person, you know. But doing it all remotely, and so it's all a little janky.
There's about 15, 20 minutes of that interview where you're trying to get him to just play each part of a solo, and he just won't, he's like, will not stay on track. And it's like off over here. And I love it because I feel for you, because it's like every few minutes you're trying to bring it back to like, could you just go back to the question I was at? But no, it's a great podcast, and they're all fun to listen to. I hope you get some more characters. I think rock and roll needs Ace Frehley's. Otherwise, it's just all boring. Oh, yeah. And, you know, too sanitized.
That was kind of what I wanted. What I really wanted my show, or want my show to be, is a little different. There's a lot of, you know, there's this online guitar world, highly musically educated and leans towards certain types of things. Nothing against all that. It's just not me, and it's not where I come from, and it's not what I am. Yeah. And so I wanted my show, like, to celebrate the highs of like the Brent Masons, the Brad Paisleys, you know, the people with like that, in those kind of like super, super high skill set type players. But also, like, if Johnny Thunders was alive, he'd be one of the first people I'd ask to be on it. Cause I love that. You know what I mean? I love the just bang it out with attitude type of player too.
Yeah.
And you know, Ace kind of slots right in there for me, where you can't discount how great of a guitar player he is and has been, and all the stuff that he did, especially back in the 70s when we were first making those Kiss records. I mean, people get sidetracked with like the fire and the blood and the makeup and the costume and everything. Just listen to what he was playing, man. The dude rips, and he's made a huge contribution. And there's, you know, generations of little kids like me that saw him with his guitar smoking and heard those songs and just went, I want to do that.
And that.
So I want my show to be, you know, to just be a little bit different. Then it's not going to all be high tech.
Brent, amazing guitar player. All those kind of Nashville session guys, amazing guitar player. But it's the Ace Frehleys that are the reason the next generation of kids are going to want to learn to play guitar. They're going to discover the Brent Masons at some point, and they're going to appreciate them for the great guitar players they are. But it's the heroes that put the makeup on and stand up on stage and do the crazy things and shred in front of 50,000 people. They're the guys.
Oh, yeah.
A bit like you're doing, you know, when you're out with the Foos, you know, that they're the guitar players that the next generation of are going to look at and go, that was the reason why I wanted to learn to play.
I think about when I was a kid and in that period when I was real little and first started playing guitar. It got so technical, and you had to be so good. Like, I was never going to be able to play like Yngwie Malmsteen or Eddie Van Halen or Randy Rose or one of those guys. You know, I just don't have that in my fingers. So luckily for me, right at the moment that I was starting to play in bands, this sort of back to basics rock and roll thing happened that was pulling way more from a guy like Ace Frehley, who I'd grown up with anyway. And I could wrap my head around that. And more importantly, I could wrap my hands around, you know, playing like an Ace Frehley guitar solo, where I was never going to be able to play with that kind of speed and technique and perfection of some of those other cats. Nothing against them, because I loved a lot of that stuff too. You talk about inspiration. The inspiration for me was seeing bands like Faster Pussycat up on stage and going like, I could totally do that. Mm. Like, I know I could play that. You know, I could go home and do that right now. And that's what makes you go start a band and play keg parties. At least that's what it did for me.
No, it's great. And honestly, on that note, I think I shall wrap up by thanking you very, very much for getting up so early, obviously, to come and join us today. But yeah, please, if you're watching this and you're thinking, I know that guy from the Foo Fighters, there's a ton more stuff to go and discover about him. So go. Is it chrisschifflettmusic.com, isn't it, where people can find out about
Indeed.
You?
Indeed.
So yeah, yes. Listen
Tickets
to the solo
are for
stuff.
Sale and all that.
If you're, you know, if you see the guys playing near you, go and see him. But yeah, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Like I say, I'll check out the dates that you're around and see if I can make it to one of the shows. But it would be cool.
Yeah,
to
come
see
on
it.
Out. Let me know. I'll throw you on the door and it'd be good to meet you in person. Thanks for having
kind.
Me.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. And likewise, if you're ever in the UK with a few days to spare and you want to come and hang out here, you know, the door is always open.
Sign me up right, next man. Summer for sure.
All right. Well, take it easy, man. We'll see you soon.
All right, buddy. All right,
take care.
Take care.
Bye. Thanks for listening to our latest podcast. If you enjoyed it, hit that subscribe button. See you next time.